Shrink Wrap Radio number 322, Mastering Resilience with Dr. Dennis Charney.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is neurologist Dr. Dennis S. Charney, and we'll be discussing the 2012 book he co-authored with Dr. Stephen M. Southwick on the topic of resilience. Dennis S. Charney, M.D., is Dean of Mount Sinai School of Medicine and Executive Vice President for Academic Affairs of the Mount Sinai Medical Center. Dr. Charney is a world expert in the neurobiology and treatment of mood and anxiety disorders. He has made fundamental contributions to the understanding of neural circuits and neurochemistry related to human anxiety, fear, and mood, as well as the discovery of new treatment for mood and anxiety disorders. He later expanded this area into pioneering research related to the psychobiological mechanisms of human resilience to stress. Early in his career, Dr. Charney led a team that determined that the biology of human anxiety disorders were characterized by excessive noradrenergic activity and dysfunction in specific neural circuits, including the prefrontal cortex, amygdala, and hippocampus. His work in depression led to new hypotheses regarding the mechanisms of antidepressant drugs and discovery of new and novel therapies for treatment-resistant depression, including lithium and ketamine, which works within hours. After decades of work on the biology of anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress disorder, Dr. Charney and colleagues have turned their attention toward investigating the psychobiological mechanisms of human resilience to stress. They've found specific hormones and peptides which contribute to resilience and have identified a prescription for enhancing human resilience. A prolific author, Dr. Charney has written more than 700 publications, including groundbreaking scientific papers, chapters, and books. Dr. Charney's most recent book is Resilience, the Science of Mastering Life's Greatest Challenges. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Dennis Charney, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. I must say you have quite a remarkable bio. I can't believe how prolific you've been in your work. So I really feel honored to have this opportunity to speak to you. And about the book that you co-authored on resilience, and I find it's really stimulated my interest in that topic. How did you first get interested in the topic of resilience?
Yeah, well, Steve Southwick, who's my co-author, has been a close friend for over 25 years, and we're both psychiatrists that have worked together over that time, and we started initially in our career, working with patients who suffer from depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. We did a lot of work, for example, with veterans from Vietnam and Afghanistan and Iraq. And about so we focused, you know, on treating patients with those problems.
Yes.
And also did research, and still do, to try to understand the causes of those problems from a psychological and neurobiological perspective. And about 15 years ago, we decided, you know, we could also learn from people who've been traumatized that either never developed post-traumatic stress disorder or depression, or if they did, they recovered. In other words, they were resilient. They were able to bounce back. So that started literally over the next 15 years, a series of projects that have changed our life personally, and also professionally, because we've gotten to meet some unbelievable people along the way that basically taught Steve and I about our resilience. And so it really started from the hope to better understand and develop new ways of treating patients with post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. And then ultimately, we think we've developed a roadmap to becoming I'm a more resilient person in general.
Well, I'm really struck by the fact that you said that both of you were affected personally by this. I wonder if you can expand on that just a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so the question is, you know, who did we get to know through the process of studying resilience? So these are the individuals we ended up studying and learning from. One was a group of prisoners of war from Vietnam, and these were men who were most of them shot down as fighter pilots and were held in prison in North Vietnam for 6 to 8 years.
Wow.
Heavily tortured, 6 to 8 years. It's unbelievable, right?
Yeah.
Heavily tortured, held in solitary confinement. And we had heard that many of them, when they got out, were very successful in life. The most prominent example being John McCain. So we ended up getting to know and videotaped interviews with over 30 prisoners of war from Vietnam.
Wow.
We then also studied members of the U.S. Special Forces, the Navy SEALs, and the Green Berets in the Army. We studied victims of earthquakes, for example, in Pakistan. We got to know individuals who lived, unfortunately, in poverty and in an environment in which abuse and crime was overly prevalent in inner city Washington, D.C. We got to know young people who were faced with congenital diseases. We even got to know very well Jerry White, who, when he was young, stepped on a landmine in Israel and ultimately formed the Landmine Survivors Network and won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997. So you can see we got to know so many different kinds of people.
Yes.
Of all different ethnic groups and socioeconomic strata. And by meeting those people, we came to admire them, came to understand how they got through tough times, and that even affected us personally.
Yeah, I could see where their stories would inspire you, would both challenge you and inspire you in your personal lives.
That's true. They became role models.
Yes.
And it's actually an important feature of becoming resilient when we face challenges in our own life, we would think back, you know, what would so-and-so do? How did so-and-so get through tough times being a POW? And that gave us our own little roadmap in our own life.
That's one of the things that I really like about your book is that you drew not only on your clinical experience from the past and the research literature, but also that you set out and you did interviews to fill out this book in terms of people's lives. And I think that makes your book particularly engaging. Now, when I think of resilience, I think of Martin Seligman and positive psychology. And I believe that Seligman has a contract with the Army to develop a resilience training program for them. Can you comment on that? And to what extent is your own thinking influenced by that work?
Yeah, Marty Seligman, yeah, who's a very famous psychologist at University of Pennsylvania.
Right.
Considered by many the father of positive psychology. He's written some very good books on that. I think our own findings are consistent with what Marty has written about, and that is the importance of optimism. We found that as a critical feature of our resilient people and kind of building on realistic optimism in your life. So I would say there that we're in line with a lot of what Marty's written about. And you are right that the U.S. Army, which truly, you know, through basic training over many, many years, you know, has worked to make young people more resilient so that they can face the enormous stress associated with deployment and combat. So, you know, they're experts in that, and they have recently taken to heart the work of many people, including Marty and ourselves too, in developing a $100 million program to incorporate ideas about resilience into the training of American soldiers. So it's one practical application of resilience research.
Yeah, and I should be quick to point out that your research on resilience actually you'd already been working on that before Marty announced positive psychology. So you've been working on this, I gather, for about 20 years. Is that right?
Yep. It's been a long time, and it's been terrific. But I don't want to underemphasize Marty's work is very influential as well.
Okay. Now, in your book, you identify 10 traits that you found that tended to recur among people who showed high levels of resilience. And I'd like to have you take us through the 10 resilience traits. But before you do so, let me say that I'm sufficiently impressed by your book that I'm thinking of offering a lifelong learning course at Sonoma State University, where I've taught for many years. And the course would be on resilience. This is just kind of an idea in the back of my mind. And my thought is that I'd like to identify a Hollywood film that would represent each of the 10 positive traits of resilience. So as you take us through those traits, I would love it if a film comes to mind that particularly illustrates that trait. And if it doesn't come to mind now in the heat of the interview, I'll contact you later by email with a request that you and your co-author come up with any suggestions that might come to mind with further reflection. Would that be okay?
Oh, that'd be great. And in fact, somewhat related. I'm a Bruce Springsteen fan, like millions of other people.
Yeah.
And I've actually given an academic talk about Bruce Springsteen's music in the context of resilience.
Huh.
That many of his songs, over the course of his career, speak to resilience and getting through tough times.
Yeah.
And so not only, I think, your point about films is a good one, music too.
Yeah, great. Well, let's
I think
go
that's
ahead
why and many people find comfort in different types of music.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and have you take us through the 10 traits that you discuss in your book, and maybe you can give us a little detail on each one.
Okay. One is positive attitude, as we were alluding to before, optimism. Optimism is strongly related to resilience, but it's a certain kind of optimism. It's realistic optimism. That is, when you're faced with a challenge in your life, you take a clear-eyed view of what the challenge is, what the obstacles that you're going to need to overcome. And then, at the same time, after you do that very realistic assessment, you have the belief that you will somehow prevail. That's realistic optimism. Pollyanna optimism, which is not resilient, not associated with resilience, it would be that you don't fully evaluate the challenge. You're just, in a sense, blindly optimistic. That gets you in trouble. If you're a soldier, that gets you killed.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
The importance is realistic optimism. And Jim Collins, the very well known author who wrote Good to Great and Built to Last, where he talks about how do you make institutions and companies great, he coined a term that I resonate with, and that's called the Stockdale Paradox. Jim Stockdale was a very heroic prisoner of war from Vietnam, who was actually the highest-ranking POW, and for his heroism as a POW, won the Medal of Honor. He was the best example of realistic optimism. Stockdale knew when he was a POW, that he was 8,000 miles away from safety. He was being held by an enemy that could kill him, so he knew the obstacle he was faced with. But at the same time, knowing the inner strength that he had, he thought he would prevail.
Wow.
So that's true, and optimism, and he did prevail. So
wow.
Optimism is very important. Now, it isn't part genetic. I'm sure yourself and many of your listeners know people in their life who just seem to be born, feeling positive.
Yeah.
And so there is that genetic component. But
I envy them.
Yeah, right. However, genes are not a destiny. You can learn to be more optimistic. There's even a form of psychotherapy called cognitive behavioral therapy that helps you become more optimistic, to see your world in a more positive way. Cognitive behavioral therapy has been shown to be very helpful for depression, for example, when depressed people tend to take a negative approach to their life. So one would be optimism.
Okay.
Another important feature of resilience is to embrace a personal moral compass, to have a set of beliefs of core beliefs that very few things can shatter. For some people, it's faith in conjunction with a strong religious or spiritual belief. For others, it can really relate to altruism, you know, the importance of doing things for others. And that's been called a survivor mission. So personal moral compass is very important. And there's even a form of a therapy called meaning therapy, which was developed by Viktor Frankl.
Sure.
Who wrote a great book that your listeners may want to look at called A Man's Search for Meaning.
Yeah, that's been influential in my own life and thinking.
So those are two. And then another is finding a resilient role model, or even resilient role models, plural. In many respects, getting on the road to recovery when faced with trauma or challenge in life starts with role models. Those are people that, in many instances, have been through what you're going through, and they can provide a roadmap on how you can get through tough times. And frequently, it's not one role model. You want to take positive attributes or characteristics from many different kinds of people that then you can imitate and help and move on. Imitation is a very powerful mode of learning.
Yeah, I think of an example in my own life where I have a good friend who I met while I was on a teaching exchange in New Hampshire. And he was the father of four boys, and somewhere in the process, I became the father of four as well. And he's just a real man's man and a sensitive guy, and he seemed to me to be such a good father, and it really helped me to kind of shoulder that burden to some extent. I mean, it's not totally a burden, but as a young father, it sometimes did seem that way.
That's right, good fathers frequently are born from other good fathers, right? They show you the way.
Yes.
Another factor is facing your fears. Fear is normal and can be used as a guide. For example, when we got to know the Navy SEALs and the Green Berets in the U.S. Special Forces, you might think that those men are fearless, but they're not. True courage is being able to overcome your fears. And so we would ask them, how do you handle your fear? And they say they use fear as a guide, that in facing fears, they would take it one step at a time, being out of your comfort zone in some respects, mastering those feelings, then moving on to the next level, mastering your fears. And so it's really like going up a ladder one step at a time, and developing a toolbox to handle things that you might be afraid of. Facing your fears can increase your self-esteem. You can practice skills necessary to move through fear. I think this has relevance even to how you might raise your children to be more resilient. Because, we have found, and many others, that if you don't provide them with some challenges, they're not going to be prepared for the inevitable challenges that we all face as adults.
Well, what would be an example of doing that as a parent?
Well, I'll give you one example from my own life. So I have five children, four daughters, one son. And every year, our family would go on some type of an adventure trip, camping, hiking, climbing. And it wasn't unusual to be in, a little bit of a scary situation, wildlife, on a mountain, that sort of thing. But you kind of learned, how to handle that. And so there was one time when one of my daughters was like 13 years old, and we were hiking. We got a little bit lost. There was some wildlife in the area, so it was a little scary. And one of my daughters said in front of everybody that she, quote, despised me. Like it came from her soul.
Wait, say that again. I think I missed a word there. Say that again.
That my one of my daughters said she despised me.
Oh, despised you. Wow.
Despised me for putting her in such a scary situation.
Uh-huh.
Now, instead of like saying, okay, you know, I won't do that anymore, we would continue, you know, every year to go on our adventure trips and so forth. And my children gained the skills to feel that it had to handle being out of their comfort zone. Well, this daughter, you know, who was like 13 years old when she said that, is now 30, very accomplished in life. And what did she do last winter? Well, she went to Yellowstone National Park in winter, snowshoes, and she's a real outdoor person.
Oh, that's great.
So it just shows, right? You can help your children move through things that may be fearful, and then, you know, before you know it, they've got all these skills as adults to handle unexpected challenges.
Yeah, that's a good example. And for myself, it maybe helps me to understand why I keep thrusting myself into positions where I have to do public speaking. And I always go through a certain amount of fear, but somehow I can't seem to break that habit.
Yeah, but you do it, right?
So I do it. That's right. I keep doing it.
So that's an important feature of being resilient. And then another feature is to establish and nurture a supportive social network. Very few can go it alone.
Mm-hmm.
We all need a safety net during times of stress. And one example we have in the book is from the POWs. So as a reminder, you know, they were held for 6 to 8 years in prison, for many of them in solitary confinement for years where you were not allowed to talk. And they told us over and over again that, you know, they would not have been able to psychologically handle, you know, that isolation unless they had developed a TAP code.
Yes, I thought that was a fascinating feature in the book.
The TAP code is that they developed a algorithm of tapping, which stood for, you know, letters in the alphabet, so that they were able to communicate through the wall by tapping on the wall to the person in the next cell.
Yeah, it wasn't Morse code. It was a different system that somebody evolved.
Yeah, so it was five rows of five letters. So you would tap what row with like one or two or three or four or five taps, and then you would tap again, you know, what number the letter was in that row. So it wasn't quite Morse code. It was five rows of five letters.
It sounds very slow, but
they were able to get to the point. They were tapping like crazy. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So it wasn't slow. Once, you know, they started doing it. And they had abbreviations for words, so they were able to carry on a conversation by tapping through the wall. So our analogy is that everybody needs a tap code. Everybody needs close relationships with people and even organizations.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure your audience can resonate, you know, with that.
Sure.
Frequently that can take the form of a group of individuals that, you know, have gone through the same challenge. Support groups of women who've been unfortunately been sexually abused, or mothers against drunk driving, where, you know, mothers lost children. Those kind of support groups can really be very helpful.
Yes, as I get older, recognize more and more the value of friends and try to hold my friends close to me and stay in contact to keep those relationships alive.
Yeah, that's very important. Yeah, you take the story of Jerry White. As I mentioned earlier in our discussion, we got to know Jerry White. And Jerry, when he was 18 years old, he was traveling in the Middle East and Israel as part of him being interested in actually Judaism, even though he was an Irish Catholic. And so he with friends, was following the path of the prophets during one summer after their early years in college. And Jerry stepped on a landmine and lost his leg. And his friends heroically got him out of the area where he stepped on the landmine. And ultimately, you know, Jerry recovered in a Israeli hospital. But what did he do with the rest of his life? He formed the Landmine Survivors Network, whose mission was to rid the planet of landmines. Princess Diana got involved. And
yes,
as I mentioned, they won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997.
Wow.
That forming that Landmine Survivors Network enabled victims of landmines to form a social network that was very supported and helped them, you know, overcome the trauma of losing a limb from stepping on a landmine. So just another example how a supportive social network, you know, is so important. And, you know, now with the internet, there are various ways to develop that kind of network.
Yes, and I think another lesson that comes out of that is really that we're challenged to turn our tragedies, to take the energy of the shock and sorrow, et cetera, of the tragedy and somehow transmute it into something in the world.
Exactly. You know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Mm-hmm. That's the true mark of somebody who's resilient, that Jerry, who lost his limb, then forms this incredible network to help so many other people. Yeah, that's where the altruism comes in also.
Yes.
So we've also found that physical well-being, attention to physical well-being is very important. Physical exercise has very positive effects on hardiness, even mood. It improves self-esteem. We have, and others have found, for example, that structured physical exercise can even have some antidepressant effects. You know, not as a primary treatment for depression, but as somebody starts to feel somewhat better, developing a regular structured physical exercise program can literally lift your mood.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been biologic studies that show that physical exercise improves brain function, improves the ability to learn and remember. It improves your ability to regulate your emotions in a positive way. We found many examples among the resilient people that we got to know where physical exercise could be very helpful.
Yeah, some time back I interviewed Dr. John Rady of Harvard about his book Spark, in which he documents much of that as well.
Yep. So Steve and I found this helpful in our own life. So encourage your listeners who may be faced with, you know, challenges in their life, that even though it might not be obvious, but physical exercise can be very helpful getting in better shape. It can be very
definitely
useful.
Yeah, definitely.
And then we have a term called cognitive flexibility. And that's where people who've been traumatized work to reevaluate the meaningfulness of what happened so that they can reframe it, assimilate it, accept it, and then recover. You take example of a woman who might have been raped. The rape is not not about them. It's not something that they should feel guilty about. So they need to accept that it happened, but then assimilate it that it did happen. But once they accept it, they can be on the road to recovery. And these skills can be learned. And even if someone perceives that they may have failed in some way, failure is an essential ingredient, you know, for personal growth. In fact, you know, when we talk to groups and mentor people, you know, we say, and I say, that if you don't fail in life, you're not trying hard enough. Because you learn from failure. You learn as a scientist that you can learn from failure, and in meeting personal challenges and, you know, trying to move beyond what you think you're capable of doing. Failure is just you can turn that into something very positive.
Yeah, and there's so many examples from the world of business where, you know, people failed in business and picked themselves up and went on to great success.
So those are many of the, you know, they're not all 10, but those are some of the most important of the factors. And I would emphasize to everybody that you can train yourself to be more resilient. The value of thinking about resilience is that it can be preventative. If you begin to think about some of these factors in your own life, so that when you're faced with something that is a challenge, you're prepared. And as I mentioned before, that can relate to raising your children, but it could also help you personally yourself to get through tough times.
Yeah. Now, you're trained as a neurologist, and one of the things that you discuss in the book is brain plasticity. Where does brain plasticity fit into what you've been talking about?
People used to think that, you know, once you took like an IQ test when you were younger, you know, that was how smart you're going to be.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of fixed. That turns out not to be the case. That, you know, the brain is almost like a muscle. That the more you use it, the better it works. And we found, and that's what's meant by brain plasticity, that if you really work at intellectual tasks, your ability to learn and remember can be improved. If you work to have a better way of controlling your emotions, the part of the brain that's involved in the regulation of emotions functions better.
Mm-hmm.
So in general, we believe, like many other scientists, that there's a lot of untapped capacity in the human brain that we don't all take advantage of it. And this was brought home to us from some of the conversations we had with the prisoners of war, where, as I mentioned, they were held in solitary confinement. So all they could had to do was think. And they were exercising their brain. And a number of them told us spontaneously, because we weren't expecting this, that they developed capacities of learning and remembering and even arithmetic calculations that they never had before, as if their brain was functioning better. So that speaks to the plasticity of the human brain.
You know, that makes me realize the degree to which I, and I suspect many other people, rely on my iPhone and Google, and it feels I refer to my iPhone as a crutch for my brain, because as my memory fails about the title of a movie or who was in the movie or some other factoid, I can whip out the iPhone and I can retrieve it. But I'm wondering if, you know, because we're in the opposite situation of the guy who's in the POW cell, it, with nothing to do other than exercise his brain, it seems like we do have these cognitive crutches. And I wonder what your thoughts might be about that.
We got to make, with proper use of the smartphones and so forth, we can do even better, right, than we are, because we got access to so much more knowledge.
Yeah.
So we want to make sure we don't use it as a crutch, but we use it as a way to get access to knowledge that previously, you know, wasn't available to everybody. So it can be a positive. But there is that risk, as you mentioned. There's also the emotional risk. You know, I have found that there are some people that when I call them on the phone, they don't answer. But when I text them, they immediately respond.
Mm-hmm.
As if they don't want to talk.
Yeah.
So I'm concerned that some people are using, some people are losing their interactive skills because they'd much rather communicate with, you know, but with people more remotely as opposed to actually talking, either on the phone or face-to-face. We don't want to have our emotional skills atrophy.
Yeah, I share that concern, even as I, you know, monitor myself closely. And I can see ways that I think, I tend to be a big fan of technology, but in recent years I'm questioning that in some ways, because I can see that I really think it's affected my attention span and perhaps even my something about the emotional relationship vector that you're discussing right now.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes people will say things, not even, I don't mean say in the verbal sense, but will report things, you know, through text, through Twitter, that they that they're not comfortable in actually saying face to face. So we don't want to lose those skills.
I just had the humorous thought of a journal on Twitter. it's an absurd thought, but it seems like we could be heading in that direction where some journal, some psychological journal or something would need to be all just very short little tweets.
Right.
One of the things that you discuss in the book that I was particularly interested in this regard is brain training software, because I've tried some of it myself, and It's funny, your book is pretty compact and it covers so much ground. And so I really like the fact that you address that question of whether this, whether there's any scientific validity and usefulness to these sorts of brain training software products that are available.
Right. Yeah, that's an important question. We have reviewed that. I would say there's some evidence that some of these, essentially, they're apps that people have developed and mind training tasks, which are designed to improve learning and memory. I would say they're somewhat effective for, quote, normal people. When it's been tested with patients with serious diseases of learning and memory, like Alzheimer's disease,
yes,
they haven't been shown to be that effective. So I would recommend them for most of us, you know, who are not suffering from specific brain problems, that they might be preventative. They might keep us sharp. As I was talking about before, with brain plasticity, I think those tasks can be helpful. We've also begun to study whether or not you can develop tests that essentially train the emotional circuits of the brain.
Okay.
So that you could have a series of tests that might have some antidepressant effects, and this research is very early, but it speaks to the fact that there might be non-pharmacological approaches to improving learning and memory on one hand, and emotional regulation on the other.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. I don't think I've come across that sort of software.
It's just at a research level now. It's not something that's generally available.
Well, we haven't mentioned any films yet, but there are a lot of macho action movies these days that depict us Americans as very heroic and resilient. And I wonder, though, to what extent contemporary American culture supports the development of resilience. Can you comment on that?
I would think that our culture still fosters resilience. If you think about role models, I think we still have, positive role models, whether it's in film, as Schindler's List. I was thinking as
yes.
I was going through the resilience factors in relation to your question about what films might be, useful. If you think of Schindler's List, where you had that the owner of a factory who helped save 1,000 Jews from extermination in the camps. That film talks about a personal moral compass,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
Schindler was also a role model. One of my favorite films is A Wonderful Life, which I think is talks about the importance of a social network, which at the end of the film, helps save Harry Bailey from maybe hurting himself. So I think if I thought about it more, there could be a lot of films that can provide kind of inspiration and a guide to make you more resilient, which is part of our culture. And certainly there are heroes in our midst that can serve as role models, whether it's, war heroes who come back, from Iraq and Afghanistan. I think if you look for them, you'll find them.
What about reading biographies and autobiographies?
I love that. Those are my favorite, actually, in terms of role models for me, like Teddy Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
I've read almost every major biography of Teddy Roosevelt because he was so amazing in so many ways, resilient. He had to face through some early childhood illnesses. It was won the Medal of Honor. President of the United States, established the first national parks. There's so many things about his life you might try to emulate. One of my favorite books that I actually give out to a lot of my faculty is Undaunted Courage, which is the story of Lewis and Clark's Corps of Discovery expedition. There's so many stories there about heroism and facing challenges and getting through tough times. So that book is essentially a biography of Lewis and Clark. Shackleton, right? The book's about Shackleton, the explorer, who went to the South Pole, didn't make it, but was able to save all of his men in a heroic adventure. So I think there's a lot to learn from biographies of people who you can admire.
Yes. Well, you've given us some things to add to our reading list here. That's great.
Yeah, definitely recommend Undaunted Courage.
I guess so, if you hand it out to all of your faculty.
I do. I hand that one out.
Yeah, that's great. I'll definitely have to add that to my list, Undaunted Courage. And can you say a little bit about the relationship between stress and resilience? I know most of us have the notion that stress equals bad.
And that's not true. So I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, I was intending to talk about that. We all face stress, and it's how we handle the stress, whether it turns out to be helpful or not. There is a term called stress inoculation.
Mm-hmm.
Meant by that is, if you are faced with, you know, minor stresses in your life, which everybody is, and you master those stresses, so you develop essentially a psychological toolbox to handle stress. And then you move on to, then you handle other stressors and other stressors. And so you start developing more and more skills in handling stress. So that then when you're faced with a really hard stress, difficult stress, you've been inoculated. You develop the skills to handle big time stress in your life. So that's where stresses with that you can handle can be valuable in becoming inoculated against the negative effects of very serious stress. It's almost like a vaccine. You know, the idea of a vaccine is to stimulate your immune system so that when you're faced, you know, for example, with a virus, you have the immune system to fight off the virus. Stress inoculation is that you develop the psychological and physiological skills to fight off the negative effects of big-time stress in your life.
Okay, and I know that it was your study of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, that kind of got you into the study of resilience. And after a traumatic experience, people often associate certain objects or places with fear, such as a fear of parks or after being attacked in a park, for example. How can we relearn those memories and disassociate those fears?
By facing your fears. What you don't want is to have the reminders of the event constrict your life. You know, so if something, you know, negative happened in a park, you don't want to start avoiding parks. You want to gradually re-expose yourself to what you're afraid of, but in a gradual way. It's called exposure therapy. So you don't do it all at once. You don't go back to the place that you're most afraid of, but you begin to approach places that somewhat remind you of the place where the trauma happened. And then you take it one step at a time, and then you overcome your fears, and you're back to your normal life. That's very important.
Yeah.
Not to become phobic.
I was at a conference recently where a professional in the audience made a striking statement to the effect that there is no lasting cure for PTSD. And I was struck by this because there are a number of therapeutic approaches that kind of make that claim that they are effective for PTSD. And I'm wondering, what's your take on that? Particularly, I'm thinking here about the challenge of all the soldiers that are returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. We've got all these therapies. Is it in fact true, though, that there is no cure for PTSD?
I don't think I put it that way.
Okay.
I would say that there are effective therapies, whether it's medicine or psychotherapy, that enable many individuals with post-traumatic stress disorder to markedly reduce any symptoms that they have and to get on and live a normal life. So I'm optimistic in that way. On the other hand, you know, there are memories of the event that will never go away. You don't erase the memories, but you are able to live with them. So I'm not sure what, you know, the professor meant. You can recover, and you can lead a normal life and have minimal symptoms. But the memories are there. And you, as I mentioned before, you assimilate those memories. You accept what happened. And that sets you on the road to recovery.
Now, speaking of those memories, perhaps you're aware that there's some research lately on the process of memory consolidation, memory reconsolidation, and some people who are working therapeutically with the notion of being able to stimulate a memory as a person's talking about the traumatic experience, and then, and I haven't reviewed this recently, so I'm not real clear on the process, but to kind of extinguish to some extent that memory or reprogram it with a different emotional viewpoint.
Yeah.
Does any of this ring a bell?
Yes. Yeah, I'm aware of the reconsolidation research.
Yes, yes.
And so that has potential for developing new modes of therapy. Basically, what that does is you have a memory, and then you elicit the memory to become, you know, more prominent in your consciousness through a reminder. And then there's an attempt to reduce the impact of that memory, the intensity of the memory, through essentially reminding people to of the memory, and then through, and these are all mainly animal studies at the point, this point, through maybe some drug therapy that you kind of alter the intensity of the memory so that it's not so fear-inducing the way it was originally. So you reconsolidate the memory in a way that is not as intense and not as fear-inducing.
Okay. Well, as we wind down here, I wonder if there are any final points you'd like to make.
I'd like to say, one, thank you for having me on your show. I hope, you know, what we talked about today is useful to your listeners. And for those listeners that are faced with challenges in their life, whether it's the economy and difficulty with employment or interpersonal relationships, or, you know, whether they had to face a serious trauma in their life, you know, I hope they found this helpful, and I want to leave them with the sense of hope and optimism that there's therapy out there, there are ways to feel better and move on with your life.
Well, that's a perfect close, and I really echo it. Dr. Dennis Charney, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're welcome.
I certainly hope you found my conversation with Dr. Dennis Charney stimulating and informative. As you know, I've had many distinguished and accomplished guests, and I have to say that Dr. Charney's bio blew me away, and it was too long for me to include the whole thing in the show notes. Resiliency is an incredibly important and universal concern, I think. One thing we can all count on is that at one or more points in our lives, we will be severely tested, whether it be the loss of property, the loss of income, the loss of friends and loved ones, or our own health. So I think it really behooves us to pay attention to developing the sorts of resiliency skills that Dr. Charney spoke about. His book is less than 200 pages in length, and despite its relative brevity, it is no lightweight self-help book. Rather, a neurologist himself, Dr. Charney goes into details about the brain, including structures, processes, hormones, and their interplay with stress. Also, the book is peppered with interesting stories from prisoners of war and survivors of other sorts of tragedies that Dr. Charney and his co-author interviewed. The book's title, again, is Resilience, The Science of Mastering Life's Greatest Challenges. It's available in paperback, and if you'd like a copy for yourself or anyone else, may I suggest you use the Amazon widget in our right-hand sidebar. K
Can you imagine your world without Shrink Wrap Radio? If you've become addicted to the show and need your Dr. Dave psychology fix on a regular basis, then you have to, need to, got to, go to the website and click on the big green donate button. The more you donate, the better you feel. It's easy and gratification is instant.
Thank you, brother-in-law Michael West. Also, I haven't mentioned our top-tier donors in a while. John Holmston, Katie Morrison of Morrison Mentoring in Melbourne, and Peter Myron. You three have set the bar really high by supporting the show at the $35 and $30 a month level. And I hope others will rise to the challenge. Also, thanks to Al T., John E., and Janice T. for being the latest people to sign up to make regular periodic donations through PayPal. And thanks to all the rest of you who have helped to support this show through your donations. If you haven't done so yet, won't you join those who have by clicking on that big green donate button? Well, I'm back from my conference in Montreal. My presentation on Google Plus there went quite well. Also, I want to give a shout-out to listener and artist Renata Selecki, who spent an afternoon giving me a bit of a tour of the city. It's good to be back home from my travels to Stockholm and Montreal, and for the past week or so, I've been playing catch-up. So now I'm going to try to get back into my regular weekly podcast frequency. I'm getting lots of great guests lined up. Let me call your attention to some of the offers in the right-hand sidebar on the Shrink Wrap Radio page. I know many, if not most of you, are listening to these interviews on a mobile device, but I really want to encourage you from time to time to actually go to our website at shrinkwrapradio.com and to check out some of the special offers that won't show up on your mobile device. For example, Peter B. Todd, who was a guest on Shrink Wrap Radio number 240, has just published his new thought-provoking book, which is titled The Individuation of God. And in the book, he goes into more detail on his near-death experience, which he talked about in our interview, and of course a great deal more. And that near-death experience was a life-changing one, and one that really led to the writing of this book. And you'll find a link to that book on Amazon in the right-hand sidebar of our site, where you'll also find a link to the 25% discount offer on all Jung platform audio and video lectures. And those are quite good. And finally, I've put up a new link that says click here to earn money taking online surveys. As you may recall, one of my other hats is that of a market researcher. In fact, that's the sort of conference that I was presenting at in Montreal. And clicking on this link will take you to one of my partners who pays quite well to people who take surveys through them, and Shrink Wrap Radio will get a small donation for each survey that you do take through them. Speaking of listening to these shows on mobile devices, let me remind you that we do have both an iPhone and an Android app, and you can get all the information about those on our site under the Apps tab. I do have one new transcript to announce, and that's for my interview with colleague Dr. Eleanor Criswell. It's number 320, and it's titled Frontiers in Somatic Therapy. I have transcribers out there who are working on additional episodes, and if you're one of them and you're listening, this is a reminder to get on it. So now, on with the show.
Hey, this is Matt Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, son Matthew. As a matter of fact, my son Matthew lives in Manhattan and was able to come up and spend a couple of days with me in Montreal after my conference was finished. We had a great father-son bonding time. I'm going to read one rather long email from our listener community, and I want to read the whole thing, even though it is long, because I resonated so strongly to so many parts of it. And it comes from listener and author Richard Powell on Vancouver Island in Canada. And Richard writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, well, I'm working my way through the older episodes, and what a gold mine they are. Since I've picked up that you don't mind reading longer than average emails, I'd like to share here some of the thoughts that have seemed particularly synchronous and meaningful for me after listening to a Shrink Wrap Radio podcast every day for several months in a row." I so appreciate that. In episode 72, he goes on to say, after the interview, you talked about a possible residual, quotes, religious neurosis, end quote, left over from your childhood exposure to your evangelical Protestant Christian grandparents. I found myself deeply identifying with you when you spoke of your teen years, your doubts, and your mounting concerns about the dark side of religious belief. I have many times observed the tendencies to blame oneself or others for lack of faith in matters of healing, new or risky endeavors, or with regard to doubts about outlandish doctrines and dogma. I've always wrestled with the strangely true duality that illness, hardship, and also wealth and opportunity happen to us and are also in some way affected or even caused by our beliefs. Also, I too experienced the pressure to speak in tongues and to do and say other things to both show that I was a, quotes, real Christian, and because friends wanted me to experience ecstatic confirmation about the existence and reality of God. I was raised in an Anglican household, converted to evangelical Christianity at the age of 15, and spent 30 years in the evangelical subculture where I met my spouse, raised a family, and worked for Christian organizations. Throughout that time, I struggled with difficult questions about the community and about doctrines and beliefs, but held my tongue with all but my closest friends because I could see that my skepticism caused people such concern. The protracted extraction of the barbs of faith that had hooked so deeply into my psyche caused me a lot of pain and suffering over those years and played no small part in the development of and long battle with a resilient anxiety disorder. I'm currently writing about this experience for a someday book and think it will be cathartic for me and potentially helpful for others. I'm sure it will be. That's me adding that parenthetically. He goes on to say, I continue to work for a Christian organization and have made a kind of peace with my religion. It has given me blessings and grief in equal measure, but I can say that about almost all aspects of life. I value the ethical compass provided by my Christian heritage, and I love the Christians I work with because they put into action their convictions about helping the poor and practicing love and kindness. The curious fact is that non-religious groups seem to have a hard time matching the track record of religious ones in caring for the poor. There really seems to be something about faith that motivates and also sustains people in selfless service. My own personal journey has taken me to a place where I accept the power and usefulness of beliefs, even when I personally don't believe them in a literal way. For my Christian friends and colleagues, this can seem like heresy, especially when I call such beliefs useful metaphors. And my questions and investigations are highly disturbing and get at the heart of what they fear most. I have come to understand that believers participate in a living myth which makes sense of the world and allows them to be highly effective, so anything that threatens this story is attacked as evil or dangerous. As a result of 30 years of study at university and throughout my adult life, I came to realize that many of the beliefs I had been taught were actually contrary to reality, logic, and the very values expressed by listener Kim in episode number 267. The ancient religions of the tribal cultures of the Middle East were reworked and reformed over the years, but many aspects of the early stages of that culture's development are preserved in the Bible and associated doctrines, and these are at odds with the values of later stages of development. I'm thinking of things like retributory justice, theocratic genocide, dietary legalism, blind obedience, rigid hierarchical social structures, and so on. It seems to me that people pick and choose the things in their religion that fit their values and more or less ignore or abandon the rest. I completely agree with Kim that respect and tolerance should be central values of Christianity and should be encouraged towards Christians as well as by Christians. Unfortunately, my careful study of Christian teachings across denominations reveals that Christianity does not, in fact, consistently promote respect and tolerance. Sam Harris's Letter to a Christian Nation helped me to admit to myself that a literalist, fundamentalist, or evangelical belief system is deeply flawed. It is my opinion that much of the anxiety I suffer as a result of living with wonderful, loving people of faith who blithely held to beliefs that are, if closely examined, unhealthy and even delusional. As Reverend Christopher Heath said in episode number 52, quotes, "The difference between a mental illness and a religious delusion actually is very hard to define," close quote. And also from that episode, quote, "The person who is religiously deluded is far more dangerous than the person who has a mental illness," close quote. It is my observation that the virtues Kim described that are found in Christianity are, in fact, universal human qualities, not exclusively evident in one religion or another. I discovered by reading widely and talking to people of other faiths that Christianity is not much better or worse than any other religion at creating a framework in which people can find or create meaningful lives. In fact, comparative religion has been a rich impetus to growth for me as I discovered ideas and practices in other religions that challenged and illuminated my own tradition. The interesting psychological question for me now is why people have to believe that their way is the best or only way. It seems to be a default position hardwired into us. Does it function primarily to bind groups together? Does it help people feel special, the custodians of a received gift of truth that no one else has? Or is it simply efficient? That is, if our way is the right way, then we don't have to spend a lot of time thinking about it. I'm also tangentially interested in the function of, quotes, positive illusions and how they relate to a healthy life and in how I can make distinctions between those illusions that are useful stories and those that cross the line and become outright delusions. For a number of years now, I've been on a quest to examine my own views and beliefs to see if they reasonably approximate what is, while recognizing Kantian logic about the inability to ever really perceive the world outside of our perceptual boxes. In this regard, I think there is much to be gleaned from the work of Claire Graves, Don Beck, and others who've made some attempts to chart the development of humans from magical and superstitious thinking to advanced worldviews that involve holding or shifting between multiple perspectives. I've not discovered a shrink wrap interview with Dr. Beck, but I have to say that his explanation of stages of development, called spiral dynamics, was one of the most helpful I encountered on the subject. Dr. Beck has applied the theory in a variety of settings around the world with remarkable results, so it is a practical theory that works in the field. I would be interested in your thoughts on this theory and on stages of development in particular. Let me insert here that I was inspired by this email to go ahead and invite Dr. Beck to talk to us about spiral dynamics because I've been hearing from it. I've been hearing about it for years from my good friend, Dr. Dale Ironson, who I also interviewed here. Okay, back to the letter. "I actually think your own story illustrates the theory in that you progressed out of the tribal culture of your grandparents through the skeptical powerhouse of science and cross-discipline, cross-cultural academia to an open view in which the value of a variety of methods, perspectives, and views can be seen without having to insist that any one view or method be the one. And again, I have to insert my own reaction here. Boy, you really get me. I really, and all of your wording here is just so good, so much better than anything I could have said. Back to the letter. Richard goes on to say, I think you really are echoing or carrying on the healing legacy of your grandparents, but the important distinction is that you are carrying it out at a higher level on the spiral that has, as the spiral dynamics folks would say, transcended and included the earlier stages. Yes, I agree. Like we did with the placebo effect, I think we have avoided studying faith and belief scientifically because so much of what was associated with faith movements was distasteful to the post-enlightenment mind. I'm happy that this is changing, and as Shrink Wrap Radio illustrates, more and more of us inhabit paradigms where multiple perspectives can be held and shared lightly with curiosity and wonder. Thank you for sharing the personal details of your life with us and the emails from listeners. I feel closer to you and to those other listeners because of it, and generally less alone. I also somewhat idly and idealistically hope that this kind of brave openness will contribute to a community of like-minded folks who can influence our culture for the better. I guess maybe I need to become more involved with the Shrink Wrap Radio Facebook group. Have you ever thought of creating a forum section on your website? I know such forums are a bit, quotes, old-fashioned these days, with the meteoric rise of Facebook, Skype, and various forms of messaging. But if done well, such forums can really give people like me a chance to connect and discuss important ideas with others who are open to them in longer, more thoughtful dialogue threads. Anyway, if nothing else, I hope this email encourages you that your presence, character, and thoughtful interactions with your guests provides valuable balance and maybe even a sense of belonging to people like me who sometimes feel distressed by a stifling monoculture, even when that culture is full of people I love. One question I have relates to the Frapper map, which you talk about in early episodes. I gather that Frapper disappeared, but wonder if there's an alternative that would provide that tangible sense of a global community. I live on Vancouver Island and would welcome the opportunity to meet other Shrink Wrap Radio listeners on the island. Maybe those are two different things, but I know that local TED groups have generally been positive outgrowths of the TED talks, and maybe there could be Shrink Wrap Radio groups too. Lastly, you may appreciate a post on my blog about the above topic called Losing the Light, and I encourage you to search out Richard Powell's blog as well as his two books, which you'll find on Amazon.com. They have Wabi Sabi in the title. And he closes, kind regards, Richard Powell. And he's got a website that will also help you find all his wonderful material at www.stillinthestream.com. And what can I say? Wow, what a thoughtful and articulate listener I'm privileged to have in Richard Powell. I'm humbled by the power of his thought and the skill of his expression, and I'm grateful to have such a listener as he is, and I know from other emails from others of you out there that he's not alone. I resonate and agree with so much of what Richard says in this email that there isn't time for me to comment on it all. The fact that I've chosen to read such a long email should be evidence of that in itself. Let me comment about the Frapper map, which Google used to offer and is no longer available. It used to allow listeners to stick a pin in a map to show where they are in the world. And I delighted in seeing all the pins in so many different places. Google stopped supporting that effort some years ago, unfortunately, and I'm looking for a replacement. In the meantime, however, I was able to use Google Analytics to discover that over the past several years, we've had listeners in more than 179 countries. You can imagine how gratifying that is to me. So with that, I think we better wrap it up here. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone or Android app, about which you can find full details on the Apps tab on our site. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Dennis Charney, for his inspiring work on resilience. My next guest will be Dr. Roland McCready, Director of Research at the Institute of Heart Math, whose mission is to facilitate a fundamental shift in health, well-being, and consciousness. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.